Jackson Harlow. Jonathan's also done some handouts. Has everybody got one of Jonathan's handouts?
Right. Good morning. This talk was originally offered as a backup, in case the proper speaker couldn't turn up. So please make allowances. Better still, imagine that the advertised speaker didn't make it, and I've nobly stepped in to fill the breach. And accordingly, this is not quite the talk as advertised. My starting point is that a philosophical proposition, question about truth is, in many respects, essentially adversarial. We have, or generate, competing views. And my question is whether a philosophical dispute is better thought of as analogous to legal process or to a boxing match. Now, the legal analogy seems to propose itself. Legal systems and procedures are set up to inquire into the truth of what has happened. And this is not merely a matter of attaching blame or penalties. It's people want to know what's happened. They feel frustrated when the facts are hidden, liberated when they become known. The success of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which didn't award penalties or damages, attests to this. As Fawzia said, the truth about who's done what has a social value, and legal systems are the principal institutions that we have for establishing that truth. A boxing match, on the other hand, takes place merely to establish who is the better fighter and to entertain the punters. Points are scored, knockouts are achieved, but we all know that on another day, that fight might have gone another way. So another way of putting my question is philosophical truth a finding or a trophy? Is it about the better philosophy? Or the better philosopher. Well, either way, one common point in philosophy is that we, or rather I, or you singular, determine the outcome. If it's law, you are the judge and jury, just like old Fury. If it's a fight, you're the ref and the judges. However, there's one big drawback to either analogy. Legal processes and boxing matches are ineluctably particular, whereas philosophical discussions are general. Particularities, if mentioned, are subsidiary in philosophy. Hume, in discussing, indeed dissing, miracles, does not feel obliged to cite a single instance. Whereas even a wide-ranging judicial inquiry like the Leveson inquiry into the press is concerned primarily with actual practice here and now. General principles like freedom of speech and privacy are subsidiary. Boxing matches are not above the principles of the noble art or fair play. I fully acknowledge the difference, and I shall ignore it. I believe that for many purposes, we may compare the processes of dispute in these different contexts, focusing on the aspects in which they are all contests with contestants. Perhaps I should just add, we leave the pokers out of the last one. I'm going to divide my comparison into three aspects. First, how is a contest initiated? Secondly, how is it to be conducted? And lastly, what determines success? So, a civil suit is rather like what happens in law, that is, when one philosopher propounds a thesis which is to displace alternative theses. If more than one alternative thesis is to be defeated, then in effect there are so many separate civil suits. The claim must be made good separately against each alternative. But while the adverse thesis in each case is in principle a general one, the philosophical claimant will usually present it in terms of the work of, one or two named exponents. Simon yesterday, for example, started off with two named exponents, and I think I counted at least a dozen more by the time he'd finished. Failure to name the exponents of a theory will have you, the court that is, thinking of straw men and less inclined to expend the court's time on an extended hearing. Ignoring private prosecutions, a criminal case arises rather differently. An initial survey shows that an offence has apparently been committed. Inquiries are made to see who can be charged with it. In France, this preliminary investigation is itself part of the judicial process conducted by a judge, while in England, it's police work embodied in a report to the public prosecutor. But either way, it's not unlike a philosophical survey of a whole topic, such as Aristotle would typically begin with. Aristotle would bring together all the opinions and views, whether from popular sentiment or individual thinkers, for his own reason. He looked for differences and tried, as far as he could, to reconcile those which seemed to be merely semantic. Then he could focus on those which were substantial. For if two arguments disagree substantially, then at least one is false. As far as the thought police are concerned, we have an offence. And, as with the civil suit analogy, while each philosophic view is stateable in general terms, it will usually be associated with the thesis as developed by named philosophers. We have not just a dispute, we have a contest. Well, there's another form of legal hearing, the judicial inquiry. And this differs from the specific cases heard in the courts in that it's not necessarily concerned with offences as such. Some event has had, or some state of affairs has, what are thought to be undesirable outcomes, and there is some doubt, perhaps, about exactly what has happened or does happen, and who, if anyone, is to blame for the undesirabilities. And there seems to be no doubt that such inquiries can be of great public benefit, not only in identifying wrongdoing and bad practice, but in clearing the air of suspicion and rumour. In a way, a judicial inquiry combines all the features of an initial inquiry into a crime with some of those of an inquest. And although a judicial inquiry has no powers to convict or to award penalties, nevertheless, there are often, but usually, interested parties concerned to throw the blame on each other, and well equipped with legal counsel to make their case. Classic instances: the shootings on Black Sunday, where you are in effect asked to compare the versions offered by the IRA and those by the army. Or the Hillsborough Stadium disaster, where in effect it is a contest between the story as told by the police and the story as told by the public. So, with only a little elision, I'm going to bring the judicial inquiry into the same category as the rest, and to see legal process as essentially, or for the purposes of this comparison, adjudicating between the contesting advocates of conflicting views. A boxing match comes into the array being rather differently. For professionals, a match is arranged which the respective managers hope will advance the reputation and earnings of their fighters, and at which the promoter hopes will be commercially profitable. For amateurs, competitive competitions will be organised between fighters who reckon to have a fair chance against each other. They must be reasonably well matched. The boxing ring is no more available for easy butchery than the philosophical journals are for the destruction of straw men. If one boxer has a title as this or that champion, then the other will nominally be the challenger, although this doesn't necessarily imply that the initiative is on that side. And likewise, the philosopher who argues against a generally accepted view, rival, say, in the concept of mind, issues a challenge. Okay, let's turn to the process, the rules of engagement in these various fields. In philosophy, as in law, the court is not supposed to arrive at any decision without a full hearing of each side. Very much an application of the principle of fair play as found in boxing and in other sports. A notable aspect of the preliminary or judicial inquiry in law is that anyone is free to offer evidence. And in this respect, those legal processes resemble Aristotle's preliminary survey, in which common opinion, what most people think, is also canvassed. And this tends to be something left out of a philosophical survey today, such as one might find in the Stanford Encyclopedia. And perhaps ordinary views could be more often considered, as in good old folk psychology. Doing this can be particularly useful in assessing whether there really is a philosophical problem at all, or are the philosophers just stirring it up? Hume and Reid made good use of this resource in dismissing the claims of reason to discredit the possibility of learning about the world from experience. Now, one obvious difference between my three processes is interaction. In philosophy, X makes his case uninterrupted, and then Y weighs in with hers. In the ring, the contestants do indeed mix it. The law is somewhere between the two, because each side is able to cross-examine the witnesses for the other. And such a procedure can be adopted for informal philosophical discussion, but it does tend to lead the debate off the main lines and into the small hours. Now, in law, there is the very useful concept of burden of proof. In general, this means that a criminal charge must be proved beyond reasonable doubt, while a civil suit is decided on the balance of probabilities. But the course of evidence, as led, may create a burden which it is for the other party to discharge. For example, once a defendant has been shown to have done something as a matter of fact, then it will be for that defendant to discharge the burden of demonstrating that he did not intend the reasonable, predictable consequences of that action. Now, in philosophy, we have a few general presumptions. I think the principle of charity may be invoked. That is a presumption that a philosopher did not intend a plainly silly or illogical view, unless that is really the only reasonable interpretation to put upon our words. And on the other hand, a claim that X has made, deliberately made false allegations, deliberately misrepresented Y by misleadingly selective quotation, amounts to a criminal charge against X, who likewise is entitled to the benefit of charity. Otherwise, it may seem that in philosophy, as in the civil courts, the balance of probabilities is the appropriate initial predisposition. In effect, we're not looking for the ideal explanation, but for best explanation. However, you, as the court, are entitled to set your own burdens of proof upon the contestants. And indeed, I recommend this exercise before you get involved in the detail of a philosophical debate. For example, if X, keep on quoting X, wants to argue that a particular sort of behaviour or activity of an organism is not a naturally evolved biochemical process, then when I'm the judge, I require X to show both why it isn't and what else it is. Otherwise, case dismissed. In some sports, a handicap may be set as a rather literal burden to be discharged by a contestant, but this doesn't apply in boxing. The contestants start square. In law, we have evidence, and the evidence must be admissible. What evidence is not admissible in philosophical debate? For most of us, the argument ad hominem is not admissible. And we may also reject claims relying on skybooks, such as Churchland's completed neuroscience, going well beyond any neurological findings it established. Also, ruled out of court, my court anyhow, are any arguments based on what X claims to be able or unable to conceive. Possible psychological interest, philosophical value, nil. In boxing, there are fouls, which, if intentional, can lead to disqualification. There's no real equivalent in philosophy. X will not be disqualified even for willful misrepresentation, as long as X has other legitimate points for consideration. but the legal reliance on evidence may seem to have a drawback as a comparison to philosophy. Would we want to consider only philosophical disputes with substantial empirical content? No metaphysics? Well, no loss for some of us, but perhaps too restrictive. The boxer's point scoring applies equally, as it were, to logical as well as to empirically made points. Better. The legal process has another drawback, as it were. The court is supposed to consider only the evidence presented. In this, of course, it's like the ring. Only what the boxers actually do determines the points. Whereas in the philosophical court that each of us sets up for himself, the judge may throw aside impartiality and argue a point on his own account. Perhaps judges do get away with a bit of this in their summing up. The notorious elegance, fragrance, and radiance of a witness in the Archer libel case comes to mind, but they're not meant to. Right. Well, let's move on to the contest itself. How do you win? Now, in law and in the ring, there can be an outright winner. The knockout has no legal equivalent, as far as I know, in the law court. But in the ring, seconds may throw in the sponge, and likewise in court. Prosecution may withdraw a charge without reservation, or the defendant may switch to a plea of guilty. And, of course, in philosophy, one party may simply concede defeat. And perhaps they do so more often if propositions hurt as much as punches. A boxer gets no points for mere footwork, however fancy, that does not achieve anything, nor for weightless punches. And this is surely the equivalent of hand waving in philosophy. Nul point. Law has one big advantage over the ring. However many points are scored by either side, they must amount to a coherent case. The defendant may claim that she wasn't there, or that she saw who really did it, but how do both? But a boxer may accumulate points in any way, change his stance or his strategy from round to round. Each point is scored on its own merits, and no consistency is required. I think that, as with fiction, we should also prefer the coherence from the legal analogy for philosophical debate. And of course, we have to see that as these are all contests, all of them, the winning owes a lot to the actual skill, the dexterity of the contestants. In the boxing ring, Gene Tunney does beat Dempsey, and Muhammad Ali does beat Foreman. That's Muhammad Ali and Foreman, by the way. In the courtroom, other things being equal, the chaff and brasses will triumph over lesser counsel. And in philosophy, Socrates will knock spots for Thrasymachus, who is left to the feeble claim that Socrates is so artful that he can make the worse appear the better case. The law has some further advantages as an analogy. Scott's law, at any rate, allows the formal verdict of not proven, which may well be the appropriate verdict in a philosophical dispute. Neither side has fully made its case. On the other hand, in a civil case, if the prosecutor fails to bring home his claim against the defendant, the likelihood is that costs will be awarded against him. And in boxing, every expedient is used to find a winner, even when the points are tied. Another advantage of the law, it doesn't attempt to deal in finality. Beyond reasonable doubt does not mean certainty. And the law has the right of appeal. Well, few philosophical disputes are confined to one showing. Many go through all the processes of a replication, a rejoinder, surrejoinder, a rebuttal, and surrebuttal, and then some. Now, there's no appeal in boxing. But there's always the rematch. Well, before I sum up, what about crossover? I know of no instance where the courts have been asked to determine a philosophical dispute. But there have been two, at least, where philosophy stood up against fisticuffs. There was the occasion when Popper warned Wittgenstein not to threaten him with a poker. He was joking, and Wittgenstein didn't see the joke. But since they were both Austrian, I refrain from ethnic stereotyping about sense of humour. And then there was the standoff between Tiger Tyson, world heavyweight champion, and Freddie Eyre, former Wayne Fleet professor of logic, which ended not in a punch-up, but in rational discussion to the credit, surely, of both parties. Well, in sum, overall, legal process does seem to offer a better analogy. Particularly useful, I think, are the notions of the prima facie case, the burden of proof, and the coherence of points made. And I also think that philosophical surveys might be readier to admit common opinion, non-expert witnesses, as Aristotle used to. But it also has to be said that philosophers, as much as boxers, need the fights. Few philosophers make a reputation or get published on the basis of agreeing with what others have said. They're not aggrieved parties, nor barristers demonstrating forensic skills. They're contenders, vying for supremacy and spoiling for a fight. Well, of course, you may disagree with this. You may say it's a dirty old tripe. Come outside and say that.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. So in the old brand, so Patrick, if you'd like to start off, and we'll be able to keep your hand up.
I don't think anybody's going to want to rehearse the slides, except they're rather funnier than the talk, so.
Jonathan, are you ready?
Yes, I'm.
I've got an acquaintance who's a barrister in Exeter, the Chambers in Exeter, and occasionally I meet up with her, and we discuss sometimes the pros and cons of the continental inquisitorial system versus the English legal system, the more adversarial system. And she says that, I said, where does truth come in? Are you interested in searching for the truth? And she says, and she looks at me, and I paraphrase, but she says, no, my function is to win the case. It's others to decide the truth of it. So she's interested in winning the case.
I think that's about how I would see it. The point is that it is not the barrister on either side who is concerned to reveal the truth. It is the court's job to determine by their verdict what the truth is. The barrister is indeed merely a contestant putting forward a version of the truth for the court's consideration. I don't think it would be very helpful if barristers did go into court saying, well, frankly, I've got a pretty duff case here, but I'll make the best of it. Or indeed, the one thing I do know, is, at least I believe is professional, is that the barrister will earnestly head off any attempt by the defendant to say, well, I've really done it, but... At that point, the barrister is in a false position and can't any longer represent the defendant. So they have some concern, but while they are not there to represent the truth, they must not be there to represent what they know to be false.
Two points really, Jonathan. One, I would like to challenge one of your assertions. You said there are no disqualifications in philosophy. I can think of one specific example, Ayn Rand, who is being disqualified from philosophy for her political reasons, for her political views, which I think is really not fair, because some of her philosophical views are highly valid,
yes,
but being completely dismissed.
More
general point, I think you've put a finger on something which troubled me yesterday. And that is the fact that the whole debate around truth seems to be a clash between reason and common sense. And that we do not give enough priority to common sense in that debate. Because common sense, notoriously, is defeasible reasoning. Whereas truth in the logical sense, as it is being presented in philosophy, is not. In logic, whatever is true cannot be made untrue by any subsequent evidence. In common sense reasoning, that is, not only is true, it is one of the fundamental features of common sense. And therefore, the whole clash, the whole ambiguity of the meaning of truth arises from this misunderstanding between two completely different concepts of truth. Would you agree with that?
I'm not sure how completely different they are. But I do agree about there being a substantial difference. I think that one of the... I think that quite a lot of philosophy does turn on what are effectively points of observation and empirical evidence. And to that extent, they will have the same sorts of evidence adduced as would be the case in a court of law. And indeed, the court of law does make use of some of the axioms of logic, as in not A and not A, which is pretty commonsensical, but no jury is asked formally to accept that by counsel on either side, but it's implicit in the whole proceeding that if one state of affairs has been shown to exist, that rules out that the opposite existed. So I don't think the difference is quite as extreme, but I do take the point, and of course it's embodied in our jury system, that in effect the decision in the court of law on the verdict is of the common sense verdict of 12 ordinary people. I'm not sure how far that would go in philosophy, because I'm not sure, unless you were supplying the drinks, how far you'd get in getting 12 ordinary people to supply the drinks.
I'm inferring from the picture you've presented that you have a fairly pessimistic view about the prospects of
actual truth emerging from philosophical discussion. Adversarial thing with winners and losers and so on. Shall I start again?
Yes, please. I think there's some people who couldn't hear you at
that. You seem to be presenting a rather pessimistic view of philosophy as largely an adversarial activity, winners and losers and so on. And in a conference about truth, I presume you're saying your picture is the one we should take rather than the notion that we will arrive at the truth. I just wondered what you would say to what I'm sure Plato and Socrates would say to you, which was refer you to the concept of the dialectic. Because the whole idea of the dialectic is and the same thing we have with the picture of the law course. We have these barristers who are head down, sort of charging like rhinos at one another, but we, standing back, have this dream that the truth emerges from this adversarial activity, not from the barristers, but from the combined activity. And the dialectical process is supposed to do the same thing. I just wonder what your view is on that.
Well, just two parts on that. Thank you very much. And I'm glad, you know, when you stood up, I thought you were threatening me, so. First, as far as the Socrates Plato, I think that there are two things confused, no, not confused, but two things go together there. The dialectic process is indeed meant to be a dialogue, an argument, a dispute, but in fact it's so wickedly rigged by Plato that it never has more than one outcome, which is the outcome that he wanted in the first place. For fight fixing, there was never anybody like Plato. On the question of the truth of propositions, I haven't developed this, but I'm beginning to get an idea about the thought that what we're going for is not truth as a yes or no value for a proposition as a whole, but that truth is a bit like heat, that one can find more or less of it in a given proposition, possibly with an absolute zero for total rubbish, but with no upper limit.
Linda, I wasn't sure if you were putting your hand up to ask a question.
No, I wasn't.
Yeah. And then Peter.
Just this question of burden of proof. That applies in the criminal court, but not, to the same extent anyway, in the civil court. The two kinds of civil law, criminal law, are based on different ideas. Civil law is to do with restoring a balance, really, between citizens. Criminal law is to restore, if it is anything, a balance between the community and the individual. And it refers back to what Fawzi was talking about yesterday. The burden of proof is there because the consequences of something going wrong in the criminal court are so much more drastic, so much more final in some cases, than they are in the civil court. I think there's quite a lot... I would say philosophy is more like the civil law than the criminal law.
I do think that there's an interesting parallel, although I'm sure the burdens of proof are not fixed with any idea on the probability theory. They do consist with it in the sense that where a crime is committed, it could in principle have been any one of thousands of people. So setting the odds high against any one of them is a good starting point. Whereas if there are only two people in dispute, one of them says the other one done wrong, then there are only two people, and to say 50-50 seems a fair start. And that is the burden of proof in civil cases. It's not that there's no burden of proof. It is the balance of probabilities which decides it. And as in a criminal court, the course of evidence led may in fact throw a further burden of proof, a heavier burden of proof, on one party or the other. If a party is shown, for example, to have allowed a deadline to pass that was put in the contract without attempting to ask for the grace or anything, then I think it's up to them to show that they haven't intended merely to void or defeat the contract. So I don't think burden of proof is completely out, even in the civil courts. In fact, it's, I regard it as one of the most valuable notions and the one which possibly of all I would most like to bring into philosophy, if I could.
Okay. I'd say burden of evidence, as is different from burden of proof. Anyway.
Yes.